Welcome. This is the 122nd episode of the Astrology Podcast. I'm Chris Brennan, and joining me today are Austin Kopic and Kelly Surtees, and we're going to be talking about the astrological forecast for September of 2017. So if this is your first time listening to the podcast, you can find out more information about how to subscribe at theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. We decided not to do a live stream today, although we are doing a sort of private stream with patrons of the Astrology Podcast who support the show by donating each time we release an episode. If you'd like to join us for that, or if you'd like to donate in support of the podcast, then you can find us on Patreon by searching for the Astrology Podcast and learning more information about that. So where should we start? So I guess it's been a month since I talked to you guys last, and maybe we could get caught up on some like news and updates type things, and then later on jump into the forecast. So we'll spend the first little bit of this talking about some stuff that's happened over the last few weeks or different news and other observations we've had, and then later we'll get into the forecast for September. So in the description page for this episode, I'll actually put a timestamp so that if you want to jump forward to the forecast portion of the episode, you can. Otherwise, you can just stick around and listen through until we get there. So the biggest thing, of course, was the eclipse. How are you guys doing, and what was your experience, or how did the eclipse go for you over the past week or two?
I feel like I almost got eclipsed. It was such a weird day where I live, just near Toronto in Canada. We had like a partial experience where the light really changed in the afternoon. So it felt like dusk. It felt like it was 9 p.m. at night in the summer, but it was only 2 in the afternoon. So it was sort of weird. I felt very, very tired, weirdly so, on that day, and just had to keep taking a lot of rest. It was in my sixth house, so that kind of made sense for me. Yeah, so that was my personal experience, just a weird vibe on the day more than anything. How about you guys?
So it was like partial in your area. It was probably not far from what I viewed here in Denver. Although I guess I'm not sure, like Toronto, I guess because it swooped down across the United States. So maybe you're a little bit further from totality, or a lot further than I expected.
Yeah, I think we had something like 60 or 70% totality was the technical description. So we still had heaps of light, I guess. I was surprised at how much light we still did have.
Okay. Did you get some glasses and stuff?
No.
No.
It was kind of hazy. So it almost, yeah, it was almost like the, with that idea of the sun being obscured, I guess it's like, where exactly do we look?
Sure.
But also because it was the middle of the day on a Monday, I was like, I've got a bit of work to do. So I just like, kept ducking out and then in and out. It was funny.
Okay. And Austin, were you like right in the path of totality there in Oregon, or where were you at relative to it?
I think we're about 2 hours south of the path of totality. It was quite dramatic here. Let's see, so we went outside and I don't know, I think it looked like it was maybe 90%. One of the sky, the light definitely dimmed considerably, and the night creatures came out. Owls began hooting. I was sitting in the backyard, and the mosquitoes, which usually don't come out until dusk, came out, started getting bitten by mosquitoes. It was obviously quite powerful. I also saw a variety of people having the energy level dip that you described, Kelly. A lot of people were complaining about being very tired in the days before and after. And, you know, what's interesting is here, even though it's not causally related, ever since the eclipse, the skies, which are usually like crystal clear mountain skies here, have been just a flat gray because of all of the ash from the forests that are burning not that far away. The air smells like smoke, and the sun comes through red when you look up. So it's kind of, post-apocalyptic looking.
Right.
The wildfires have been out of control. And there's supposed to be wildfires in this area. That's part of the natural cycle, but it's very intense.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in terms of, that's really interesting because I hadn't thought about that until it happened and I started reading about it more, that like the animals and stuff and other insects, because it gets so dark, it literally is like it's suddenly nighttime in the middle of the day. And it's one thing to actually you know, sort of say that theoretically versus to experience it. So, I mean, Lisa and I just went out to a park here in Denver because we decided not to go north to Wyoming because we heard that like 500,000 people were flocking there and they'd been planning it out 5 years in advance. And we figured it would be too crazy to, you know, want to deal with that. And I don't know if I'll end up regretting that. I guess I do a little bit, but we still saw the eclipse take place. And we were sitting in a park for a couple of hours with our glasses. And it was quite a spectacle to behold. I mean, it's much more of a visceral type experience to witness an astronomical alignment like that happening in real time. And it was a little bit more, not intense, but a little bit more striking even than I expected.
It is different to experience it, I think. And that's part of the beauty of observational stars of astrology is the experience. I caught up with Kenneth Miller when I was out in San Diego earlier in August. And he talked about one of the take on the eclipse from the Vedic or the Indian tradition, where it really matters what else is happening in the sky on the day of the eclipse. So he was saying we don't, like an Indian astrologer wouldn't necessarily give an eclipse forecast or interpretation ahead of the event because they would incorporate, experience of the day, you know, so was it cloudy at the time? Was it windy? And they would sort of factor that in. So it becomes, I guess, more experiential, sort of what you're alluding to, Chris, the felt experience, I guess, rather than just the theory of it all.
Right. And taking into account like the omens, other omens that are non-astrological surrounding at the time, that's something that the Indian tradition is much better about that used to be part of the Western tradition. And you would see things like Infirmicus Maternus. He talks about, you know, if lightning strikes when some major astrological alignment happens, and it means this or other things like that. All right. So other things in terms of the eclipse, just any final thoughts on it? I mean, I had a funny Mercury retrograde thing happen where Demetra George and I were going to record an episode of the podcast. It was going to be episode 121 last week, but we kind of got Mercury retrograded where I sent her a nice microphone and we wrote our outline and prepared for it for a few days and got ready to record and then got time to do it. And then her computer didn't recognize the microphone for some weird reason that's never happened to me. So we actually, after like 90 minutes of trying to record that episode, had to give up. And shortly after the eclipse, she's somebody who has Leo rising, and the eclipse therefore was around her ascendant. And she actually discovered that there was some sort of heart problem going on and she needed to have surgery. So she actually went in for that the morning after we were supposed to do the podcast. And I've heard that she's doing okay, but it was one of the interesting sort of things as I started noticing some of the people around me and different ways in which different people got hit by the eclipse when it was hitting personal points in their chart. Did you guys have any things like that in terms of noticing friends or clients or anyone getting hit in interesting ways?
I saw a couple things that repeated themselves. One was a bunch of car accidents in the week following. A bunch of eye infections. For those of you who are on video, my left eye is a little strange and red right now for reasons that I don't, you know, that I can only connect to the eclipse because nothing's happened to my eye and I don't have eye infections. But I heard that from a bunch of other people. I mean, insofar as we're looking as, you know, we can look at this eclipse as being specifically oriented to the United States, a tremendously destructive hurricane that's been taking place in Texas, which is interesting because eclipse and disaster historically go hand in hand. But I think it's a little interesting that it's not an area that was on the eclipse path. It's definitely part of the nation that was eclipsed. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, the skies are full of ash here. And this is, I think, just a slightly more intense version of what happens every year in August and September. But it's at least made a poetic backdrop for it. I also saw a lot of couples get in nasty, nasty fights or break up and get back together with surprising rapidity.
Interesting. Yeah, and it's weird because it was, of course, also coinciding with this Mercury retrograde period where it's stationed in Virgo, and we're only now, halfway through that because we just had the Sun-Mercury conjunction, I guess, a day or two ago, and we're going to be on the other side of that now over the next week or two. Yeah, and then in terms of world events, I mean, a lot of the focus on us, but from astrologers, was on the fact that it would fall, the eclipse is falling on Trump's ascendant conjunct Regulus. And I thought it was really interesting in the news that later that same day of the eclipse that he announced plans to escalate the war in Afghanistan, which in reality, I mean, doesn't seem like a huge announcement relative to what some of the astrologers were sort of like concerned that it could be like a much more major event or something like that. Although I wonder if that doesn't imply that that action or that development won't have greater long-term significance than you otherwise might think that it should.
Yeah, there's that. There's also, if we're just looking at the band of 2 weeks between the two eclipses, that was when the whole Charlottesville thing happened, which is certainly unfavorable for Mr. Trump. And also, you know, it's kind of, somebody pointed this out and I noted it myself, that you had, you know, people who were openly Nazis or neo-Nazis marching, and that a lot of those, you know, historically they've used the black sun on their flags, right? Like the black sun is often used by Nazis for Nazis. And it was interesting as we were coming up on a big Black Sun event that you had those people out and in public in greater numbers and louder and getting more national attention than they have in I don't know how long.
Yeah. I mean, that was a huge deal that was happening for especially that 2 week between the eclipses. And now it seems like that's, I don't know, not died off completely, but the hurricane's like taken the focus in the news. But that was a huge thing that was going on for a couple of weeks. And it was interesting how, you know, a lot of the focus then ended up being on Trump in terms of whether he was repudiating some of those groups or not, or attempting to blame both sides or whatever.
Yeah. Well, he also lost a lot of the people left his business council, the captains of industry abandoned him, and he lost support among the some of the Republicans, and there were a number of people who quit. There were a lot of people who tossed down his banner and refused to hold it anymore.
Sure. And then the final thing is just, this is something that came up in my interview with Bernadette Brady, and this is actually because we did an interview about her work on eclipses, but this is a point where I felt like I had a major disagreement with her, where she was much more focused on, and she said the events associated with an eclipse should take place at the time of the eclipse. But there's this whole other tradition, and it was in the context of trying to talk about like the medieval tradition, where sometimes they say, and if an eclipse takes place under this condition, then the effect will happen, or the event associated will happen 3 months later, or 6 months, or 9 months, or what have you. And that's something the more and more I've thought about it over the last few weeks, that I really feel even more strongly, which is that, you know, eclipses sometimes can coincide immediately with events, but sometimes they can also like initiate a sequence of events where the full outcome of it isn't really clear until a while later. And that's something that happens kind of frequently in different parts of astrology, that it seems like it's important to recognize. But with eclipses, especially because they sometimes tie together these longer periods of like 6 month intervals, where you have the eclipse season, where the, you know, new moon and full moon starts taking place close to the nodes in the different signs, or over like a year and a half or almost 2 year period, you have just a series of eclipses bouncing back and forth between two signs. And that's, there's a sort of interconnection between a lot of the events that take place in between those periods, it seems like to me. I mean, how do you guys feel about that? Or where do you come down in terms of, you know, eclipses taking place with events immediately versus sometimes there being a delay of some sort?
I don't even think it's a discussion. I think that's, of course, what it does. Sometimes they're immediate things, but it's a seed. I don't even think that's a debate. I'm really surprised that Bernadette expressed that opinion.
Yeah, I was a little surprised as well. I mean, had you heard that before, Kelly? Or I mean, and maybe...
No. And I listened to, I think, the first half of that podcast, because Bernadette was one of my very first astrology teachers years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Being Aussie gals, she was probably the second person that I learned astrology from.
I love her work on the Fixed Stars.
Yeah.
Just to say something nice and respectful.
Oh, she's got some amazing stuff. And her book, Predictive Astrology, The Eagle and the Lark, which is where all of her eclipse research is a great reference for just, you know, transits and progressions and that type of thing. One thing I did really relate to with Bernadette when she was sort of saying is that being a working astrologer, which she has always been a consulting astrologer, that she is really trying to refine her practice into what can I tell people about what's going to happen and obviously give some really accurate dates. So I thought that was interesting. I do find the eclipses in that sense are hit and miss because sometimes you'll have an eclipse in the events on the day and sometimes it does unfold over the 3 to 6 months after. So I think I'd have to agree with Austin on this, that it's not always on the day itself. So that does surprise me as well.
And, you know, I'm a little meh about using a 6 month range for an individual's transits, you know, an individual chart. Like there's something there, but I definitely use the 2 weeks following and preceding, like 2 weeks between the eclipses and the 2 weeks after the second eclipse, but before we get a regular new moon or full moon. Like those are lunar cycles, which are very specifically seeded by eclipses. And so, you know, I see a lot of stuff like 2 days later, 3 days before, like that's really, really, really common. It's very rare. I actually can't think of an example where there wasn't anything in the weeks surrounding an eclipse, and then it ended up signifying something big 4 months later. I think if you're going to have an echo like that, you will have an initial sound within that much smaller time period, you know, which will then bounce around through the next 6 months.
That's a really good point, because I think, that's probably what I would really agree with, is we do need to have something relatively close to the eclipse date. And it's got to be a chart that's really activated by the eclipse, in the same way, Chris, you were just saying with Trump and that announcement around this war with Afghanistan, which sort of kind of got lost in the mix with all the other stuff that was happening at that time. But it will be interesting to see what that leads to, what that was a foreshadowing of in the coming weeks and months.
Right. Well, and it just brings up this recurring issue that I've talked about many times before on the podcast, which is sometimes an event can take place in a person's life that's important or personally that will impact them, but they're not fully aware of it at the time, or they don't realize the implications of it at the time. Like sometimes you can have an eclipse happen. I've seen somebody, for example, who had an eclipse happen and met a new person, or a new person came into their life that they would later get into a major relationship with, but they didn't realize at the time that that meeting would be so significant, or that that would be the person that they would later go on to marry or something like that. And so that's actually a real issue just in terms of researching astrology in general, the fact that sometimes in the moment, it's not always clear what the significance of events are, or they're not always necessarily in the person's field of vision. And it certainly complicates things when it comes to studying the effects of things like eclipses, especially.
For sure.
All right. Let's see. So I'm trying to think if there's any other eclipse things before we move on, but I think that was pretty much it. In terms of other recent news, did you guys see, I just released an episode with Gemini Brett today where we talked about observational astronomy and talked about this like weird debate that happened this weekend in the astrological community where this thing about like the flat earth theory came up. Did you guys see that taking place or going on?
I think that it's very generous to characterize that as a debate, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, it was Julia from the CIA Cosmic Intelligence Agency group, like posted a link to some astrologer who on YouTube was like trying to promote the flat earth theory. And I didn't know there were like any astrologers who believed in this or even entertained this as a thing, but now I know there's at least one or two. And she linked to it saying, hey, isn't this absurd? And then the guy showed up on her Facebook page and started freaking out and like throwing personal attacks and insults at her. And then anybody that tried to challenge him, he started attacking and like stalking them. It was really kind of insane. Did you actually saw it, Austin?
I became aware of it afterwards.
Okay. What were your thoughts on that? I mean, had you seen, I was like vaguely aware of the flat earth theory as a like thing that was out there that some people thought that I didn't pay much attention to, but it didn't really become relevant until I saw some astrologer who has like 70,000 followers on YouTube actually evidently promoting it recently.
Yeah, I still don't think it's relevant.
Sure.
It's a bit crazy that it happened, and it's crazy that somebody just went a little bit berserk, I guess. And it just seems like a crazy concept about which one would go so intensely about.
Sure. I guess the only way it was relevant, or that where we, Brett and I, tried to frame our discussion about it earlier, that I released earlier today, was just that, unfortunately, one of the realizations that I had and that we had in dealing with these people or thinking about how you would deal with a person who's promoting such a crazy theory about the nature of the solar system or the cosmos or the earth or what have you is, unfortunately, when you sort of step outside of yourself and think about it, you realize that most scientists would actually view astrologers the way that we view and would sort of immediately reject something as crazy as the flat earth theory. And there was something a little bit disturbing to me from a personal and a sort of philosophical perspective when thinking about and realizing that. And that's not meant to say that we should entertain it or treat it more respectably or as more anything connected with reality than we should, but at least giving us some perspective sometimes on how outsiders sometimes deal with astrologers in some instances. No, not really. Not willing to go that far. No.
I didn't catch it at the time, so I feel like I'm
Well, what I would just say is a very important difference is that astrologers take in all of the facts and then do more. We don't reject facts about the physical structure of the cosmos and substitute in made up stuff. We start with the facts and then we go further using the facts as a base, but there's a huge difference in method there. And sure, if someone thinks you're crazy, then it might be kind of parallel to you thinking someone else is crazy. But I think that's about where the parallel ends.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all in terms of the parallel. I mean, there is an issue where the way that most astronomers assume that astrology is defined is that it's like celestial influences that are directly influencing and causing terrestrial events to happen or people to behave in certain ways. And as far as they're concerned or as far as they know, there's no such mechanism that could explain that. And so you get into similar territory in terms of the physical sciences from that standpoint. But obviously, flat earth theory is a much more sort of insane thing to even contemplate because of everything we know about the solar system and the world or the globe and how it just becomes like the mother of all these other conspiracy theories where they start saying it's like a government conspiracy to like suppress knowledge of this and all of this other things. Anyway, so sorry to sort of dwell on that, but it just kind of blew my mind because I hadn't seen anything like that. And it also brought up these other questions about like standardization in the field or, you know, why it's useful for astrologers to have some background in astronomy or even like the certification question is often brought up in the context of, you know, improving the standards of astrology or other things like that. But you actually run into an issue where, you know, every once in a while you will run into somebody who is claiming to practice as an astrologer, but is genuinely kind of insane. And this was kind of an instance of that. And the issue is, you know, what do you do or what do we do as a community? And the answer is that you can't really do anything because the lack of the standardization in the field or certification means that anybody can put themselves out as an astrologer and anybody can basically say anything. But even though I'm somebody who's usually against certification or not really that on board with the idea of standardization in the way that some of the organizations have taken it, this is one of those instances that actually gave me pause and made me wonder if something like that isn't more relevant than I sometimes think it is. I mean, do things like that ever, do you guys think about things like that, or does that give you any pause in terms of that question?
I don't think that that's actually an answer. there are groups that certify astrologers and hold them to a certain standard. It doesn't stop people from being astrologers outside of that, unless you would like there to be solid laws on the books that one cannot practice as an astrologer unless they've done, you know, the equivalent of astro med school, just like a person can't practice as a doctor unless they've done that. You know, unless you have that level of total control linked to certification, then it's not a solve at all.
Right. And I'm not willing to go that far. And I understand the pitfalls if you go that direction and why those would be major drawbacks, because some of the best astrologers are self-trained and have done no certification whatsoever. And that certainly at this point in the astrological community is not, you know, really reflective of the quality of a person's work. But I guess I was just saying, this is the extreme end of the spectrum of not having anything like that within our community. And it does seem problematic. And it's just, it gave me a sort of glimpse into what the other argument could be and what the issues are for a second that I hadn't really fully considered as much in the past.
Does it seem crazier to you than like Pleiadian ascension 2012-ness, which we've had for a long time in the astrological community? Because it just kind of seems like that's the, you know, that's that side of things.
I mean, yeah.
And that's like still been around. I guess it to me, it just seems like a new version of that. It's like it's the 2017 version of, you know, astro crazy.
No, just because it incorporates like 20 different conspiracy theories into its thing. Like it says that like the moon landing was a hoax and that the government is like suppressing all of this and that the globe, the world is literally flat and that any pictures that have been taken from space or anything are fabricated and just like all this other crazy stuff. So that it becomes much more disconnected from reality, even things that are easily demonstrated or demonstrable. So that it seems much different than that. But then you do get into that question of where would you draw the line if you were trying to create standards in the field, or when is it okay to call something out as being bogus versus when is it not okay to question somebody's approach to astrology or cosmology or their belief system or what have you? Because that's one of the issues in the astrological community that where this is relevant is there was actually some astrologers that defended the flat earth guy and attacked Julia for saying, how dare you criticize this guy's belief system or this guy's approach to astrology?
It sort of raises that question about what someone believes versus what is true. And it sort of veers into maybe the territory around religion, to my mind, which is people do believe things that aren't grounded in maybe a fact or a truth, if that makes sense. And it's that gray area between, you know, if this is what they believe, I mean, from our perspective, we're like, that's factually incorrect. And Austin, you made a beautiful point where it's like, we take the facts and we build on them as astrologers. We use a foundation in the natural world and then look to, you know, create some meaning from that. It is a tricky question because where do you put the line there? And I mean, part of me is just sort of thinking, sure, the line can maybe it moves for different groups, but at least to agree from some starting foundation principles, I guess. And what's so almost shocking about this experience is that this person is taking their foundation back 500 or 600 years to something that has been disproved. And that I can't really get on board with how that could be okay, I guess.
Right. And I guess there's no way to say, you know, I'm certainly not condoning it, but I'm just using it as an extreme example of one of the discussions that's come up in the community lately is just relativism. Like relativism is a philosophy that many astrologers are adopting in order to deal with the fact that there's so many different traditions and approaches to astrology and religion and cosmology and all these other things. And, you know, at what point does it go too far? Because this is an obvious example where I think most astrologers would agree this is way too far and you've crossed the line. But where is that line then? And is it possible to draw it?
And that's a really good point. Where would the line be? And could we get, I mean, and then we'd have to all have an agreement, I guess, around that this is the line. The thing it makes me think of to sort of speak to your point, Austin, around that idea of medical standards or, you know, having to do this practicing certificate, is there something different as an intermediary, something like the Masons or some sort of trade level where it's like we all agree on these basic principles. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I can see, Chris, why it's really prompted this food for thought for you.
Yeah. Well, when have astrologers all agreed on anything?
Yep. I mean, hello, house systems.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, most astrologers agree that the world is round, and until
that's,
like a couple
that's
of
true.
No, I mean on organizing themselves in a political manner, which that would require. It would also require the government to, the United States government at least, to recognize astrology and as valid in order to treat it like medicine. I think that it's not a road worth thinking about because it's simply not going to happen, or at least not, you know, for a hundred years.
Well, no, we don't have to. We can have internal standards within the community without having the government like that.
We already do, and it doesn't stop that.
No, we don't. We've started over the past 10 years with some certification processes, but each organization is doing their own thing. The quality of all of them is pretty poor because I've seen some of them. So any efforts to do any sort of certification or standardization are still in their infancy, if anything, and none of them have been organized community-wide. So it's not that we have that or that already exists. It hardly exists, and it's not community-wide. So before you'd have to talk about that before you'd even get to the point of saying that the government's going to be involved or something like that.
I mean, if you want to talk about the standards, it's a tricky issue, the standards issue, I guess, because do we have one country that sets the standard for everyone globally? Does each country create some standards for themselves? I agree with your point, Chris, that there are not a lot of consistent standards, and that even, you know, in the US alone, there are three or four different organizations that certify people. I know just from my experience with Australia, we just have one organization that certifies, but I don't know. It would be an interesting thing to see if astrologers could organize in that way. I don't know. I think it's great to do structured training for people who want to be an astrologer. Whether we could all come together, I'm not sure. I mean, I'd sort of be interested to see what that might look like.
Sure. Well, it's just something that will be interesting because that discussion's only been happening for a decade or two in terms of standardization and attempts to move towards that world. The astrological organizations in the US, for example, have only adopted ethics rules in the past 10 years. But as more and more traditions continue to be revived and developed over the course of the next decade or two, and as all these old traditions are coming into play, it will be interesting to see what sort of synthesis happens in the future and if standardization is just completely impossible as a result of that, or if the merging of the different traditions at some point could allow for some basic form of standardization to take place in the future, and if at least there's a few baselines that astrologers could agree on, such as the world being around or what have you. But anyways, so maybe that's enough for that discussion, and we could move on to the forecast section of this.
Cool.
Okay. So last month we focused on sort of the most pressing or obviously prominent thing from the top of the episode, but a few people asked if we could actually do things more in order this month, just because it might be a little bit easier to follow in the audio version. So if we sort of start at the top of the month, what's the first thing that sort of comes up in the forecast for September that we might want to talk about?
First thing, for me, I mean, I'm just planning out the month ahead for my website here. So I have a month with all the scribble on it. Mars trine Uranus on Saturday the 2nd, and then the first of the two Mercury Mars conjunctions that we're going to have this month on Sunday the 3rd. So that looks like a fairly, I mean, Mars Uranus, I kind of like Mars Uranus aspects. Maybe I have a freaky fascination with chaos, but from a personal perspective, the way I see that manifest for clients and for friends and that type of thing, Mars trine Uranus can be about really getting some stuff done. Definitely that kind of combustible energy, but this is a trine, I guess, not a square. The Mercury Mars, that's sort of this prickly energy that I think we're going to have to deal with a little in September. We do have two iterations of Mercury Mars. The first is in Leo on the 3rd, and the second is in Virgo on the 16th. So I think the one on the 16th is a little tempered because we've got the cooling groundedness of Virgo coming in, but the Mercury Mars on the 3rd, maybe, you know, heated discussions, outbursts, maybe some volatile conversations, or, you know, that sort of foot in mouth disease, I guess we call it. So that, you know, from the very start of the month, they're the two things I'm looking at the very beginning.
Okay. Right. And so we get the Mercury Mars conjunction, and the retrograde is wrapping up relatively early in the month on the 5th, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Mercury's direct in Leo on September 5th. And what degree does it station on? Is it at 28?
It is at 28. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty hot thing. I think we might've kind of flagged that last month to chat about. You've probably got some thoughts on that, Austin.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that happens the first week, right? Yeah. So we have Mercury back in Leo at the beginning of the month, and Mars and Mercury are mutually applying to a conjunction with each other. And so, you know, that happens on the third, or early morning on the third, night of the second. So Sunday night, if you're in the Western Hemisphere. And then pretty much right after that, or a day after that, we get Mars entering Virgo, right? Switching. And then we have Mercury stationing direct pretty much at the same time. And mm-hmm. then we have the full moon. It's boom, boom, boom. On
the 5th and 6th. Yeah.
Yeah. 4th, 5th, 6th. So that's a lot going on. And so, you know, like you said, I mean, Mercury Mars is squabbly, right? It's squabbly. People, you know, you tend to get more, you tend to get even more rancor in the media and publicly. People say nasty things to each other. People threaten each other. I don't know. Maybe that's another, you know, spat between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, or it could be a lot of other things. There are a lot of hot spots these days, right? But then what's interesting, and you have Mars entering a Mercury-ruled sign, right? So even though the conjunction is breaking up, it's, you know, it's still Mars-Mercury, and we've got another Mars-Mercury behind that, you know, coming up a week and a half later. But what's interesting to me is that there's a very strong contrast with that full moon.
Yes. You know,
it's a full moon in Pisces, and it's a full moon conjunct Neptune in Pisces, which is certainly not aggressively verbal. Right. Those aren't words that we associate with either with
I'm
any
not
of
sure
that complex.
Get aggressive or verbal out of that full moon.
You know, you said something earlier, Kelly. You're like, oh, you know, just waiting for that full moon. And I had this the phrase that popped in my mind was like coming to wash away our sins, or at least feel
that's
like
beautiful.
Like, you know, at least for a tiny little bit. It might not actually do it, but it might feel like it. For a little bit. I think that I think it's going to mellow out some of the Mercury Mars stuff. In a very few cases, it'll just add crazy to it, right? Mm-hmm. But in general, I think it's going to mellow it out. It's not really configured to it. And so I think it also, you know, it switches us out of eclipse time.
Yes.
Right. It's the first lunation that we've had since it will be the first lunation we've had since July that is not eclipsed. Right. Yeah. And it moves us out of this, you know, the 2 weeks since the total solar. And so I think there will be some relief. And even though, you know, Mercury's direct station will be prickly because it's near Mars, it is a direct station, you know. I often experience a certain relief and an ability to think and write in the days leading up to and following Mercury's direct station. There's usually a bit of clarity. Some people, especially people with natal retrogrades, might not like it as much, but for most people and most things, the direct station is an occasion for a nice sigh.
That feeling of a nice sigh is really what I get coming out of this full moon, like this 24-hour period of washing away our sins, cleansing, softening, I don't know, healing, feeling. And not everyone's going to love that vibe, because I think there's definitely going to be this air of confusion coming through. Maybe not, because Mercury's station literally the 24 hours before the full moon, maybe not the best time to be making high level detailed decisions, but I think a great time for, you know, maybe relaxing or taking a chill, stepping back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so there's the, you know, the moment and day of the full moon, but the moon's in Pisces for, you know, over 2.5 days, right? So it's all going to kind of have that feeling about it.
It's going to be nicely tempered.
And it's kind of nice for people with, you know, Leo rising or with fixed signs, just because this is also basically, as Mercury is stationing, the first day that Mars finally clears that sign in a while, and therefore removes some of the agitation or other things that may have been associated with that transit over the course of the past month or so.
Yeah, definitely. But there is more Mercury Mars stuff waiting.
Yes, we're not done with it, but...
And so, you know what's really fun about the upcoming Mercury Mars, which is the second one, which occurs in September, is that's the 16th. That is the day that there are simultaneous Juggalo and Trump supporter marches on Washington. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
No.
Okay, so there's a big pro-Trump rally scheduled for September 16th that just happens to be the day that a massive Juggalo or ICP Insane Clown Posse fans were scheduled to march on Washington. And
literally, there's going to be clowns marching and Trump people marching.
Right, scary clowns. And the scary clown people are very much not the pro-Trump people, at least as far as the internet can see. And so we're gearing up for a heated clown clash in Washington. Look on the internet. It's hopefully it's not violent, but it will definitely be hilarious. It's hilarious that it's even happening.
When is this?
This is the 16th. This is the day of the Mercury Mars, the second Mercury Mars conjunction.
Okay, there it is in Virgo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that Mercury Mars conjunction is tough, because when we were looking at elections this month, it's like it falls right in the middle of the month and it's applying for much of the first half. And so it's this weird thing that you have to sort of like get around for a big part of the month.
Yeah, it's kind of, especially once Mercury goes back into Virgo on the 9th, which is probably the first interesting thing that happens after Mercury's direct station. But once Mercury goes back into Virgo on the evening of the 9th, then you've got Mercury and Mars applying and in the same sign and 3 degrees or less away from each other. And so even though, yeah, there's a conjunction on the, you know, 2nd/3rd, and then there's another conjunction on the 16th, that will be a relatively constant background for more than the first half of the month. Because even when Mercury conjoins Mars, it then passes it by a minute and then 2 minutes. And so it's going to take us really until close to the end of the month to really get a meaningful separation between those two.
Right. And it looks like even once it is, then it's like applying to square Saturn at 21 Sag for a good chunk of the month.
Yeah.
That's fun.
I think at least Mercury's in Virgo. That's right. The saving grace.
So how do we live with basically 3 weeks of Mercury Mars?
I mean, one of my solutions from an electional standpoint was to try to do stuff at night, because at least if it's a night chart, you can diffuse some of that Mars being in the more malefic side of the spectrum, and especially the fact that, as Kelly said, it's in Virgo, so you have reception between Mercury and Mars, so there's also some mitigation. It's like there's ways to work around it, at least from a technical, you know, standpoint or an electional standpoint, but how you get around that from a social standpoint is maybe a much different question.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that Mercury, Mars, and Virgo would be really good for technical or mechanical writing or researching. It's maybe not going to be ideal for the pleasant, sweet stuff. So that's what that feels like. If you had a lot of tech, if you had a big editing project to do, if you had a detailed writing thing to do, tackling things in a decisive way. I mean, that Mercury in Virgo has a lot of, dignity or strength, I guess, but you know, that can exaggerate the tendency to overanalyze things. And at least with the Mars there, you can maybe cut or decide and not totally let the mind run away, but it is prickly. And then, of course, the one of the contrast energies to that is the Venus-Jupiter sextile, which is happening just a little before that second exact Mercury-Mars conjunction. So the 14th and 15th, we've got Venus on the North Node, Venus sextile Jupiter, and Jupiter is very close to the fixed star Spica or Spica then as well. So these feel like two very contradictory energies in the things or the topics that they're activating, because that Venus Jupiter does feel more collaborative or more supportive rather than the Mercury Mars. But I'm interested to get the take that you guys might have on that.
Yeah, I would agree with that very strongly if Jupiter wasn't coming right up on that opposition with Uranus.
Okay.
You know, I think that what I've seen watching the Jupiter-Uranus oppositions this year is that Uranus in Aries totally gets to ruin the peacemaking that Jupiter in Libra tries to do.
Okay.
And that, you know, the Uranus in Aries is ruled by Mars. So, I mean, I'd rather have that Venus-Jupiter sextile than not.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that even that configuration is actually relatively volatilized, especially okay. also because you got Venus on the North Node. And the North Node does not favor clarity or balance.
No, it's extreme for sure.
Greedy. You're just saying from like an Indian perspective of the nodes representing destabilization?
I mean, yeah, the Indian perspective is definitely part of my perspective on the nodes. I've fed myself with everything I can find. I would agree with, I think that what is often said in Jyotish about that is true.
Sure. I was just asking because I know some, the medieval astrologers would look at a benefic North Node conjunction and say, oh, that's positive because the nodes increase the power of the benefics and magnify them. And therefore that's a positive conjunction.
Yeah, I think that I think it's positive for some of Venus's significations. I just don't think that as a part of this larger set of configurations, it'd end up being useful.
Okay, sure. It is nice just to speak to your point briefly, Kelly, that there is at least reception as well in terms of that sextile, so that it's mm-hmm. strengthening the ties a little bit even more than it would normally be in terms of a sextile between Venus and Jupiter.
Totally. And I think I can see where you're coming from, Austin. And it's not that I disagree, because I think the Jupiter component is very much all about Uranus this month. But for specific Venus things, if I think, well, you know, Venus is on the North Node sextile Jupiter, she is going to trine Uranus shortly after this. But it just feels like some sort of breakthrough or, you know, a pushing forward. And that is not always easy or smooth, but it can bring progress that is at least maybe motivating, or, you know, that idea of this is my vision and I'm doing something towards it, I guess. Just from, if I think, you know, Venus gets that benefit of Jupiter. I mean, I do think about planets in fire signs as being a little bit primal, so not always grounded, which is definitely part of, I guess, the issue with the whole larger Uranus in Aries cycle. So it's interesting, the different takes on the nodes for sure.
Yeah, that's always been one of my issues with the nodes, is reconciling the different traditions, just because it's like the medieval tradition has this specific approach that's partially derived from conceptual things. The Indian tradition has this specific approach, and then the modern tradition has developed its own approach more recently surrounding them and what the middle point is between those when it comes into specific rules of making a prediction about what, you know, a specific placement like Venus conjunct the node means, and whether the nodes are being treated like destabilizing influences or like magnifying influences or what have you.
Yeah, well, I would say that the North Node actually destabilizes by magnifying. And mm-hmm. A lot of Indian texts would say the same thing. They, you know, one quick way to say it is that what is a very common opinion in Jyotish is that the North Node is good for material significations, but it's bad for spiritual significations. It makes you rich, but not happy.
Yeah. And the reverse is true too, right? The South Node can make you, it's more spiritualized in its nature, but not great for material stuff.
Right, right. And so both of those are destabilizing and can be seen as beneficial in one way and malefic in another. It depends on, you know, which side you've bet on. If you want a bunch of money, a South Node thing is not going to be helpful for that.
No way. No way.
Sure. So this actually becomes relevant in terms of some of the elections that Lisa and I were looking for this month. And we had a really hard time figuring out which one to highlight in the forecast episode as a result of that, just because we found some that had some good positive things, but there were always some major drawbacks. And a lot of the drawbacks made it so that there wasn't really a good one that stood out very well. So let me share the one that we decided to promote as sort of one of the main elections that we found and to explain the pros and cons surrounding it. So it takes place on September 10th, 2017 at 2:08 or approximately 2:08 a.m. We set it for Denver, Colorado, but the important thing is just to make sure that Cancer is rising. Specifically, we have about 23 degrees of Cancer rising, although you could adjust that a little bit depending on what you're trying to highlight in the chart, but just make sure you have Cancer rising. So,
Chris, just quickly, did you pick 23 Cancer because it's in the direct square to Jupiter?
Yeah. Lisa sort of nailed or narrowed that down, and she wanted to make it square to Jupiter in order to make Jupiter even more prominent than it already is by being in the fourth house and not that far from the IC. You could really adjust it and do a few different things in terms of that. I mean, you could back the ascendant up and make it so that it's sextile the Mercury-Mars conjunction or the Sun in the third house in order to energize those placements a little bit more, even though they're cadent. Mm-hmm. You could try to move the MC forward, but I don't know if you can get it forward enough to trine Venus while Cancer is still rising. I mean, there's a few different options. So this one's not as closely timed as some of them. And that's why I was saying that just focus on getting Cancer rising more than anything. So the chart has Cancer rising, and the ruler of the ascendant, which is the most important planet in the election, is the moon, which is exalted in Taurus in a night chart. It's completely in aversion to, or is not aspected by Saturn, which is good since this is a night chart, and that would be potentially hampering, especially if there's a hard aspect between those two. The moon is applying to a square with Venus and a trine with the sun eventually. And it's otherwise placed in the 11th house, so that this chart is to some extent 11th house focused in terms of groups and alliances and other things of that nature. Sort of, it would be good for 11th house type matters. The other thing about this chart, and the reason why I wanted to highlight it, is because, like Austin and I were talking about earlier, the Mercury-Mars conjunction is really prominent this month, and in pretty much any time any of the day charts you try to do or day chart elections, you run into this issue, especially around the first part or the middle of the month, where you've got a pretty prominent Mercury-Mars conjunction, which can be problematic because it can cause can correlate with discord or divisiveness or other things like that. And if that's not what you're going for in your election, then you don't want to necessarily emphasize that, but instead you want to find ways to mitigate it. And one of the two primary ways that you can mitigate it is, one, by making it a night chart, so that applying conjunction between Mercury and Mars is not going to be as destabilizing for Mercury, and Mars is not going to be acting as much of a malefic in this chart. So that's one of the things we have going in this chart, is just trying to mitigate what is otherwise a rather prominent Mercury-Mars conjunction. So it's a night chart. It also has reception, which also takes some of the edge off of the conjunction between Mercury and Mars. We've got Venus in the second house of financial matters in a night chart, which is somewhat positive for finances, but that's when the major drawback comes down for this chart, which is the thing that I really didn't like about it, but it's the only thing that I can't really avoid, which is that there's a pretty close applying square between the Sun and Saturn within about 3 degrees, which is a serious sort of problematic condition in this chart that's actually maltreating or afflicting the Sun. And as the ruler of the second house, the Sun is primarily sort of acting out financial matters in this chart. So I don't think, even though Venus is in the second, that this would be a very good chart for financial matters. But in terms of 11th house matters focused on groups or friends or alliances, or even to some extent third house matters involving communication, potentially travel, although this is like 2 a.m. So unfortunately, you're going to have to be either staying up very late or getting up very early to use anything under this chart. but financial matters would probably not be a great one because the ruler of this second is so afflicted.
That's really too bad, because if the sun wasn't afflicted, that would actually be a great money chart.
Yeah, with Venus in the second house.
Yeah. And big juicy Taurus moon, Cancer rising, getting ruled by that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things where it does have so many positive things, where it's probably one of those situations where things might go well initially because you have Venus in the second house doing relatively well in a night chart, but then because the ruler is declining and it's afflicted by Saturn, things might not turn out very well later on after.
Yeah, or they might just move like painstakingly slow.
Right.
With that sun Saturn. Like, it might be like, yeah, we're making progress, and it's like less progress every whatever. So maybe not a good long-term election. Maybe more something to use for things that aren't going to endure for years.
Sure, definitely. That's definitely good advice, especially with things that are where there's an emphasis on like cadent placements like there are in this chart rather than angular ones. So yeah, so that's the chart. It also has Jupiter angular in the fourth house. So it's like trying to make the benefics more prominent and trying to put the most difficult planet in this chart, which is Saturn, in a night chart, putting it sort of out of the way where it's in the sixth house. So that really the only planet that it's seriously harming is the sun. But otherwise, it's not like majorly prominent in this chart and therefore is not as much of an issue as it could be. So that's our one election that we're going to highlight for September. Lisa found five other electional charts for September that we're going to talk about in the Auspicious Elections podcast, which is available to patrons on the $5 or $10 tier. All of the other charts pretty much have this same dynamic, though, this month where, you know, there's some really positive things, and that's why we picked out those charts and emphasized those things. But then there's some major drawbacks as well, like in this instance, the sun being afflicted. In other charts, it's other things like dealing with the Mercury-Mars conjunction or other things like that. But this is a workable chart if you want to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning on September 10th.
Love it. I mean, it does feature one of the aspects that I didn't know if you guys wanted to speak to briefly, the Sun square Saturn aspect that is going to happen around the 13th of September. I often notice clients really struggling with, you know, choices between personal preferences versus that duty obligation side of things when we get hard Sun Saturn aspects. Is that something you guys have noticed as well?
Yeah, it's also a deadline-y aspect.
A like what, sorry?
It's deadline-y, like people will probably like on
a
find... deadline.
Yeah, I'm like, that's a technical term I haven't heard, but I'm familiar with deadlines. Got yeah, it.
Not
yeah,
a technical like term.
coming up against the deadlines. Perfect.
Right. It's just like where I imagine a lot of deadlines are going to land, either self-imposed or otherwise. We're like, oh, I said I would get it done by mid-September. And it's that same sort of like, I don't want to do it. Oh, I got to do it. I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of feel.
Totally that. I mean, and one thing I like or appreciate about hard angles between the sun and Saturn is it really shows if you really don't want to do something, then make a different choice going forward. Just don't say yes to it. Or I think that idea of like Saturn and restructuring sometimes comes through. Sometimes you don't want to do something and that's just because you're feeling lazy, but you know, once you get into it, you'll actually really enjoy the process.
That's something I see with Saturn. I experience with Saturn stuff a lot is there's like this initial, I don't know, you've got to get some momentum going on your own. And then once you do it, then it becomes not so bad. But there's like looking at the Saturn obligation from the outside and from the position of rejection and just thinking about how much you don't want to do it and building up a little complex about it or a little cathexis. But then when you actually do it, you're like, okay, this is not unendurable.
No. I mean, and that's the great thing about Saturn too, is that his tests are often endurable. It's just a matter of deciding whether you want to take that test at that time. That's the choice, I guess. Well, so I thought I'd mention that aspect quickly while we're there. Sorry, Austin.
No, I think that's important. And I like what you said about commitments. You know, whenever there's an encounter with Saturn, it brings up the commitments that we have made in the past that are now, you know, rising to the forefront. And although it's usually, you know, it's often too late to uncommit without being a flake at that point, yeah, it can give you some food for thought for next time somebody says, will you do this at this time? Or will you commit to, you know, X, Y, or Z? You can remember the last time you were miserable because you said you were going to do something and you had to do it. But yeah, it's food. And that's so Saturn. It's right. It's food for thought for the future. Right.
Totally.
Definitely. So is there anything else? We're at the middle of the month and we've talked about the, because in the notes, it was sort of like, you know, we had the Mercury ingress September 9th and then it sort of jumps forward a little bit. We've talked about Venus conjunct the node and sextile Jupiter, which happens around the middle of the month. And then it seems like the next thing really is Venus's ingress into Virgo September 19th, which happens right around the same time as the new moon in Virgo on September 20th.
Yes. And Mercury will oppose Neptune on the 19th as well. So that we do kind of then skip ahead from the middle of the month to that 19th, 20th.
Yeah. I mean, after the Mercury-Mars conjunction, they both move on. They move on towards oppositions with Neptune, which is interesting. And certainly doesn't portend a period of clarity following whatever verbal exchanges occur during the Mercury-Mars.
Right. And that's what we actually started this retrograde under, because Mercury stationed at like 12 or 13 opposite Neptune, right?
That's a really good point. Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah. Coming back to that place. And, you know, I mean, shadows are worth thinking about normally, but this is especially important because the relationship is Mercury was like, oh, it's Neptune and I'm going to oppose Neptune. Then I'm going to come back and then do it again, right? It's coming back to an event that began the Mercury retrograde rather than just the space in which it began.
Right. It's a not different, but it certainly will amplify whatever that process of leaving the shadow period is and whatever the initial sequence of events were that started the Mercury retrograde period, and then coming back and revisiting them one final time?
Yeah. So on that note, I have a question. One of the things I surmised at the beginning of the Mercury retrograde and have seen as a theme in addition to the obvious solar eclipse themes is people trying to pierce the Neptunian veil with this Mercury retrograde starting opposite Neptune, like people trying to, you know, find out what the real situation is and get down to it, but often being quite confused and exchanging one illusion for another. It seems like there's been this in the background Mercury trying to cut through or figure out a way to cut through Neptune. Is that something y'all have seen at all?
I hadn't thought about it quite like that, but it's a really interesting point, Austin.
I mean, I mainly just bought a laptop that I had to return and got screwed with technology and electronic things this time around.
Yeah, I got some good ones. I'm in a Mercury perfected year, so every one of these is just wrecking house on me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. The only weird thing we've had here is my husband is so frustrated with me because I haven't bought a new phone yet.
I haven't bought a new phone yet either. I lost mine. I left mine on a plane. I haven't had a phone for like 3 weeks.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I still have mine, but I'm a pretty dedicated not iPhone person. So I have a BlackBerry and it does need to be updated. It's not running a particular app that my family uses to communicate all the time. WhatsApp doesn't run on my old BlackBerry thing. And so my husband gets so frustrated when he wakes up in the morning and there's like 50 messages from my family in Australia. And he's like, you got to look at this damn phone. And when are we buying you a phone? And I keep delaying it. And I'm like, after Mercury retrograde, I hadn't even factored in the Mercury opposition with Neptune. So it's going to have to wait till I get back from my next trip.
So that reminds me, a good friend of mine who's a Pisces, he has what he calls Pisces voicemail, which is where you just don't ever set up your voicemail. So no one can ever leave voicemails.
That's brilliant.
And I have to say, you guys probably made the smart decision because every once in a while you have to just give in and do whatever the thing is that you have to do during the Mercury retrograde. And then you have to go through a lot more hassle. Yeah, you just have to deal with it. And like, that's kind of the lesson is like, you know, and having to sometimes push through or strive through being part of the process and that being healthy, or sometimes having things just go awry and having to deal with that. But then, you know, every once in a while as an astrologer, you also have that experience of just wanting to test it or wanting to push it, and or feeling like you have to do it at the time, even though you know what the transits are. So me getting that new laptop was like, I'd been without a laptop for like a month, and it was having serious problems in terms of keeping on top of email and in terms of doing the podcast and everything else. So at the beginning of this retrograde, I was just like, I have to do this. And I just, you know, hopefully it won't be too bad. But then I got the laptop and it immediately had issues, and it's been a process of getting it repaired and sending it back over the course of the past 3 weeks, through a series of different funny disasters with it. So I respect your restraint, both of you, in not getting your phones during the course of that and having more strength than I did not to test it out.
You know, Chris, as complimentary as that is, I don't think it was my restraint or discipline that was responsible for me not getting
it. I think it was just Neptune vagueness at my end.
Sure. I was like, oh, no, I'm really busy. Yeah, I'll do it later.
Do it later. Yeah. Not a conscious decision.
Got it.
So let's talk about the new moon.
Oh, the Virgo new moon on the 20th.
Yeah. So
let's do it. What do you want to say, Austin?
I don't know. I'm going to say it's at 27 degrees Virgo.
Yeah.
The last decan of Virgo is not very
Virgo new moon.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is if you look at that, that is five visible planets in Virgo for that moment.
Yes.
Right.
Which is worth noting. The last decan of Virgo has some, I would say it's very entropic. You see a lot of physical things falling apart. All of the images are basically dead bodies or bodies being prepared for burial, or you know, being
so uplifting, Austin.
Well, that's what the images are.
That's what it is. I know.
Some of them, dude. Some of the decans are full of, you know, happy, fun, victory stuff.
And this isn't one of them.
This is not one of them. This is this one. It's good for it's concerned with legacies and consequences which extend beyond the immediate, right? Like what is the legacy of your life or your administration or your, you know, whatever your work. It's it has to do like when, you know, when this falls apart, as it always will, everything falls apart, everything given a body falls apart over time, what will the legacy be? And so that's the sort of spiritual mental level of it. But it's often very hard on people's health. It's hard on people's health, and it's not good for their things.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's hard on people's health. Which I think even a modern astrologer might get to with all this Virgo.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're looking at like, you know, yeah, I agree that there are other methods to come to that conclusion.
I like the decans. I love the images. They're so rich, Austin. And then, of course, as you pointed out, you guys pointed out, this Virgo new moon is ruled by Mercury, which is still within that 3-degree window of conjunction, which I think is a definition of maltreatment, right? With Mars.
Yeah, it's usually within 3 degrees. That was one of the reasons why the Sun-Saturn thing was so important earlier. Yeah,
and perfectly opposite Neptune within 7 minutes.
Oh, Mercury, yeah, the opposition is right there.
Right, that's such a crucial turning point. So we've really pinpointed one of the core, it seems like, hot spots of September right around this new moon, just because we have the new moon going exact at 27 Virgo, Mercury hitting that opposition with Neptune at 12 Virgo Pisces and simultaneously leaving its shadow right around that degree range. And then at the same time, Venus, just right before that, has just ingressed into Virgo and joined the party.
Yes. And it is quite the party.
Well, and that means, I mean, so among the many things that that means, one of them is that we're finally done with all the Leo business.
Yes.
Right.
Finally.
Yes.
So no more North Node Leo stuff for a while. And instead we're dealing with, it's a very Virgo September, at least once it gets going.
Yeah. But this latter part for sure.
Yeah. That's a really great point also, because this is like the lunation. This is exactly one lunar month after the solar eclipse. So yes. that we finally get to that point. And even though we've already had the previous lunation, this is like the next new moon after that solar eclipse new moon at 28 degrees Leo. So we're finally fully free of that, both in terms of all the planets moving out of that sign, but also in terms of moving on to the very next lunation cycle.
Yeah.
All right. So this is September 19th and or September 19th, September 20th. And then after that point, the next big thing that takes place is the sun actually ingresses into Libra just a few days later, right?
It does. It
looks like that's about September 22nd.
Yes. I think you're getting it. So it could be the 23rd on the East Coast or in Australia, I guess, just depending. Yeah.
Okay. So we get the sun's ingress into Libra about the September 22nd and thus ends summer in the Northern Hemisphere, at least.
Yes. And winter in the Southern.
Right. The end of winter in the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, although Australia's a little quirky and they do it at the end of the month rather than actually on the solstice and the equinox. But, I mean, there are other countries in the Southern Hemisphere that probably stick more.
What do you mean by that, or what do you – could you
– So they – like in Australia, they would celebrate the start of spring. They actually celebrate it on the 1st of September, if I'm remembering correctly. And our Aussie listeners will let me know. So we don't actually – like, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, we say the season starts on the solstice or the equinox. In Australia, they would have it on the start of the month beforehand.
Okay, got it.
A little, yeah. I mean, and that's not what necessarily astrologers in Australia would do. That would be like if I asked my dad, who doesn't really know much about astrology at all, you know, when does spring start or when does summer start? You know, summer starts on the 1st of December, not the solstice.
Got it.
Which is just a quirk, country's quirk.
Sure.
Yeah. And then I guess the next big aspect is actually when Mars opposes Neptune.
Yeah, it looks like September 24th, we get the exact Mars-Neptune opposition at the same degrees that Mercury basically opposed Neptune. So we get the other side of that continuing sort of drama of planets moving through Virgo and hitting that opposition with Neptune.
Yeah, and this is an interesting couple of days, the 24th and 25th. We have the Mars-Neptune opposition, which is like getting caught in the haze or... you know, the fog has descended and how do you move forward when you can't, your plan doesn't hold up. And I always think Mars-Neptune aspects are like trying to drive through very heavy fog and you have to almost feel your way forward or intuit and maybe you have to slow your pace because the details or the data or the perspective is not there. But we also have very, very quickly after the Mercury-Saturn square is kicking in, the Mercury at 21 Virgo. So September is full of these sort of, you know, there's periods where there's 3 or 4 days and there's no big aspects. And then we have 2 or 3 things happening within the same 48-hour period. And I don't know, I think Mercury-Saturn versus Mars-Neptune, again, two very different types of aspects. But very curious to hear what you guys think about this.
Yeah. What do you think, Austin, of contrasting earlier in the month, we had the Mercury-Mars versus later in the month, we have the Mercury-Saturn square being completed?
It looks like there are a lot of details that need to be attended to and that it will not be easy to attend to them.
Correct.
We have the planets trying to operate from Virgo and being afflicted from various angles, right? Neptune, Neptune, I don't generally class as a malefic, but when you apply Neptune to Mercurial affairs, I think it's totally malefic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Saturn's definitely malefic. And so, you know, with the Mercury, Saturn, the Mars, Neptune, that's a lot of resistance. You know, you may want to be, how shall we say, understanding about timetables during this
flexible.
Last 10 days. Yeah. Things may take longer than you planned. And, getting upset about that will probably not make them go any faster.
Yeah, that seems like great advice for Mercury Saturn, just because like you were saying earlier, Saturn often slows things down, but it can also sort of reject or say no to things. So the attempt to do something in terms of Mercury or to communicate something can be met with resistance or with opposition. And the question that you that comes up oftentimes during those times is whether to it's one of those things where you have to persist and push through the opposition, or whether it's something where you have to you've met a wall that you cannot go further through and you have to sort of like give up.
Yeah, I would consider this to be almost an anti-election for mercurial matters.
Right.
I like that, Austin. Like a date to avoid rather than a date to elect.
Or like if you wanted to pick a really bad electional chart for something, that could be like a sport or something.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, you know, speaking of of things that happened last month, you know, in August, one of the things that I think was interesting that millions and millions and millions and millions of people watched was the big boxing match between Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor. And I thought it was very interesting that it occurred on the day that Mercury was Kazemi the Sun, Mercury retrograde Kazemi the Sun in Virgo at about 3 degrees. Because, you know, if we're talking about bringing clarity to something, there was all this talk from all these people, you know, imagining 1,000 different scenarios where Floyd Mayweather was going to knock him out without getting touched, or Conor McGregor was going to dive in there from the sky and punch him in the mouth, and that was going to be that. And there was this giant cloud of hype surrounding that fight. And then with the Mercury-Sun conjunction, everybody got to see what actually happened. And it was a pretty good fight, right? Floyd Mayweather won. He's the better boxer, but it wasn't embarrassing. Nobody... You know, none of the extreme or hyped up scenarios happened. It was a really interesting example of like, okay, here's the Mercury Sun conjunction in the middle of the retrograde. Here's what it actually is, especially in Virgo. Here are the facts. Like, this is the number of punches landed. This is what happened. And after like months of crazy hype, I think it's one of the most hype fights ever. Each of the participants made at least $100 million.
Wow.
So anyway, yeah, just a little, and that was right after the solar eclipse too, which there's a little there's definitely an element of solar eclipse happening there. And there's certainly that element of clarifying. And if we take Mercury as in part ruling athletic contests of many sorts, which is very common traditional signification, you know, the Sun clarified Mercury, you know, clarified the result of that athletic contest on that very day. Anyway, so it should have gone in our earlier section, but I just remembered it now. That would be worth at least describing.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, that fight, because of how big it was. But I looked and we actually had a birth time that looks reliable for Conor McGregor. And
oh, really?
It was super fascinating that he's actually a night chart with Saturn at 27 degrees of Sagittarius, because that's the other thing that was happening this past week, of course, is we got the final station, the direct station of Saturn in Sagittarius. And this is the last time that it will make a station in Sagittarius before it goes direct and finishes up its very last pass of the last few degrees of Sagittarius. And that is, of course, where he has his natal Saturn placement at 27 degrees Sag. So this big fight was actually, and his loss of this fight was part of his Saturn return. And that, of course, has some interesting echoes that we've talked about a year or two ago of Ronda Rousey, who was another, you know, fighter who had Saturn in Sag and suffered a pretty major defeat as she was going through her Saturn return.
Oh, a pair of them.
Yeah, two major defeats.
Yeah, and I would say that they effectively destroyed her career, whereas Conor McGregor actually won the respect of a lot of the boxing world and got $100 million. But he lost the fight. He got punched in the face a lot in front of millions of people, which is, I think we could classify as unfavorable.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting contrast, or it raises some interesting questions about then what is the difference between somebody who, you know, with Ronda Rousey, potentially her career is effectively over, versus somebody like Conor McGregor, where it was a huge payday and he lost. And certainly that was not the hoped for outcome of on his part. And perhaps he, you know, who knows how hard he took that personally. But at the same time, he also got a lot of respect, and his career is certainly not over, I don't think, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. People will be begging him to fight. He's proven that he can bring in hundreds of millions of dollars as a draw to events. He's proved that he can actually stand. He went 10 rounds with what many people believe to be the best boxer in the world and possibly, you know, of all time. You know, he didn't just jump in there.
It was a respectable, like, you know, when we say this in rugby too, you never want to watch a washout because that's not enjoyable. You want to actually see a good match. So if he went 10 rounds, then,
yeah,
you know, he held his own, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And so the event as a whole was a giant win for him, even though he was the loser of the contest.
Sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. The loser, but still the big payday. Sorry, Chris.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was pretty much it. So this is one of, I'm collecting the very last of my, you know, Saturn and Sagittarius, Saturn return examples before doing some kind of episode about that, as we're getting towards the end of Saturn and Sagittarius. And this is just one of the other interesting ones to show another side of that that I found over the past couple of years, or one of the more recent ones. So if you guys happen to notice any more, let me know. Or if anybody listening happens to notice any good Saturn and Sagittarius Saturn return stories, definitely let me know, since I'm trying to get the material together for that to do an episode at some point in the next few months.
That would be a good episode.
Yeah. Speaking of Saturn, I think there's two quick points I'd make, one about Saturn and one about Jupiter for September as a whole. We do have Saturn. Well, you just sort of said this, Chris. Saturn is now bouncing off its station. So Saturn in Sag is now making its last pass through that third decan, that third part of Sag. And this is it. This is like the final hurrah of Saturn in Sag, because we're just having Saturn move forward until December when it moves into Cap. And this month, September, Jupiter will cross its station degree from earlier this year. So Jupiter is pushing into the last 7 degrees of Libra for the first time, and then, of course, going into Scorpio next month, which I'm sure we'll talk about in that episode. But there's just something interesting with both Jupiter and Saturn clearing station degrees or coming off station that really feels moving forward and certainly pulling away from this eclipse energy, that there's some different stuff coming through with Jupiter and Saturn over the next little while.
Yeah, definitely. It's closing something up or winding down rather than starting something new. What was the degree that Jupiter stationed again? I can't remember offhand.
I think it was 23.
Okay.
Yeah, it was right around there, 22, 23, in February. And then it went direct at 13, and it's just clearing the previous station. Yes. But yeah, this fall is, you know, like Chris said, it's about wrapping things up. It's wrapping up this entire Saturn Sag chapter. And the next chapter is very different, and we'll have plenty to say about it. But, you know, I think that being inside this year, and especially this last part of this year, a lot of things seem really important that when we're looking at this time period 2 years from now, we'll sort of be like, oh, we missed it. That wasn't actually what, like, there's all this stuff right around the corner, all this, you know, Saturn and Cap stuff. And we were just so busy with our eclipses and our Saturn and Sagittarius. I don't mean you, like you guys and myself, as astrologers, we're talking about this month.
Right? Generally and collectively.
But I think collectively, a lot of people are going to be like, oh, I thought blank was so important. It was so loud and dramatic, but it ended up that blank was way more important.
Yeah, definitely. And it's funny looking back sometimes at past times or past years when that has happened, because you see all of the attention being on one thing, and then in retrospect or in hindsight, you know, it's clear that it was something else that looked small, perhaps at the beginning, that ended up having the greater significance.
Yeah.
All right. So the very last things happen at the very, very end of the month. There's like three,
yes,
sort of a succession of three quick things that happen, right?
Yes, there are three things. We're going to have what's really saving the best for last. Third hit, Jupiter-Uranus opposition, Mercury moving into Libra, and Venus opposite Neptune. Are they the three things that you meant? I hope so.
Yeah, I think those are the three. Pluto stationing on September 28th, Jupiter opposing Uranus on the 28th, and then Mercury ingressing into Libra around the 29th.
Oh, the Pluto station as well. Yes.
Yeah, so Pluto's, what was the fourth one you mentioned?
Venus opposite Neptune.
Oh yeah, good call. So we get
to continue
third,
the theme.
Right. Yeah. So the third planet in September in that succession of oppositions with Neptune is finally Venus at 12 degrees of Pisces, So really anybody, do you guys have anything around that? But anybody with like 12 mutable placements, you're going to get this weird sort of succession of those three inner planets hitting Neptune during the course of the month. And it seems like if you have anything near those degrees, that could be a sensitive point this month, in addition to like Mercury leaving its shadow there, so that whatever the retrograde station was that set everything up with the Mercury retrograde was the sort of starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I know what it's going to be for me. I have the Sun at 14 and Saturn at 10.
Yeah, I was like, Austin and I will be all over this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've already planned it. I didn't think about it in terms of every detail that we've discussed. I was like, oh, this is when I dig myself out. September, we're not having any guests. We've had a lot of guests over the summer. No guests. I'm digging myself out of my work hole. I'm getting ahead. I'm catching up on things like car registration, et cetera, et cetera. It's literally just the plan is Virgo clean up the Neptune mess, cleaning up my diet, blah, blah, blah. Like it's very clear for me what that's going to be. And there may be parallels for other people who have planets there. It's just like cleaning it up after kind of a crazy summer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense just as a metaphor for this shift from like dealing with this so much Leo over the past month or two and then shifting to having so many planets in not just an Earth sign, but having them all in Virgo over the course of September, basically.
Yeah, and it's and like we noted a couple times, it's a lot of Virgo. Like we've got, I think, minimum three planets in Virgo.
At any one time.
What is it? Once we get past the ninth?
The ninth when Mercury moves in.
Right.
Yeah.
And then even when the sun leaves, we've still got three planets in Virgo.
Yeah, because by then Venus is in. Yeah. So I guess, you know, wherever you have Virgo in your chart, whatever house it rules, that is a lot of getting a lot of attention this month.
Yeah, I would look at wherever Virgo is trying to clean up wherever Pisces is. Right, because Neptune is the spill or the mess or the you know the area of life which has become less organized than it could be.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
So we need to talk about the Jupiter-Uranus.
Jupiter-Uranus. Yeah.
It sort of outranks almost everything we've been talking about.
And so this is the final one. This is Jupiter is cruising at this point, and it's on its way out of Libra. And we've been talking about this since the very first one was last December, right?
Yeah, end of December 1st hit, early March 2nd hit.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, you know, back then when we started talking about it, because we knew it was going to be the first of three, and we were sort of expecting a lot of sort of unexpected developments and things like that to take place right from the start. But there's often this thing that's a little bit annoying with some of those transits where there's going to be three of them, where sometimes it's not the first one or two that you have the clearest sort of manifestation of it, but instead you get a sequence or a series of hits. And sometimes that third and final one is the one that carries the greatest punch, it seems like. I don't know if you guys have seen that as well or if that's how you feel about it, but this will be the third and final exact opposition between Jupiter and Uranus.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other two were very protesty. Which is a pretty basic Uranus, Jupiter, Libra, Aries sort of thing. A lot of people, I mean, we had a lot of, they were very protesty. And that protesty, demonstration-y theme has been very strong since the Uranus, Jupiter started in December. And it hasn't been merely left or merely right. There's been a lot of like standing up and making much noise. And, you know, like what's interesting is with Jupiter and Libra, you know, it's like, hey, we want justice. And Uranus and Aries, Uranus and a Mars ruled sign, seems to, how should we say, stimulate a very vigorous version of that rather than the sort of quiet diplomatic version of that. One of the cultural themes, which I've seen the Uranus-Jupiter tension oversee, is I've seen Jupiter's like trying to bring people into whatever the middle ground is, and Uranus is like, no, we can't do that, right? And in ways both right and wrong, right? But Uranus in Aries is not a let's compromise and let's all figure this out together. It's okay if you're kind of wrong. I can accept that. you know, Uranus in Aries is uncompromising. Uranus is always uncompromising, and Aries is hardly a compromising sign. Whereas Jupiter is a compromising planet, and Libra is a compromising sign. And so it seems like there's been this tension or this back and forth throughout the year. Be like, well, maybe we can all just come together. No way we can come together if that's going to be the case. And so, you know, I've seen it in all sorts of different versions. And, you know, with the Jupiter and Libra, I see as having a very nice idea. But sometimes that doesn't work. Like with the Trump Charlottesville thing, right? Like the, you know, equating the, you know, the white supremacist protesters with the Antifa, people being like, yeah, they're all wrong. It's like, yeah, not really. And he has Jupiter in Libra natally. Mm. Right. But then there are other circumstances where actually middle ground would have been great. There was a real middle ground, but then, you know, but anyway, it's this tension back and forth, that I've seen those two sort of lording over. As far as what I would expect from the Jupiter Uranus thing, the third and final, I would expect more massive demonstrations for, you know, on, I don't know on which side or which sides or whatever, but I would certainly expect a public drama and outcry.
Sure. That's interesting. And the idea of like false equivalents, because I feel like I've seen that in a few different cropping up in a few different areas lately. And that's an interesting idea to tie that into the Jupiter Uranus opposition.
Yeah. It's a thing. It's like, well, maybe we can come together. No, we can't come together, right? Or not with that. Yeah, anyway.
Sure. So, and I'm trying to remember, I mean, were there any other things about the Jupiter-Uranus opposition over the course of the past year? I mean, that's a really good point, tying it into some of the protest things that were happening. I mean, I remember it most vividly last year for something, you know, when a lot of the Trump had just been elected and some of the astrologers were like thinking, or some of the Democratic astrologers were thinking in the US that, you know, oh, is something crazy going to happen with like the Electoral College or something like that? And that didn't really materialize. But I'm trying to think if there are any other things like that where something truly unexpected did happen. When was the second pass? I'm trying to remember when that exact second opposition was.
Early March.
March 2nd.
Okay. And I'm trying to remember what was going on back at that point, or what that one was even about at this point, in order to understand the full sequence of like what these three oppositions have been about from a mundane perspective. But I'm having trouble even remembering what was going on with that in terms of March.
I'm not 100% sure.
I was right in the middle of moving, which was both Jupiterian and Uranian.
Yeah, I was in the middle of just launching the book and the craze surrounding that in terms of very, very quick. I mean, that was very Jupiter-Uranus in terms of it happened like suddenly and unexpectedly, because Amazon decided to launch my book 2 weeks early and very quickly sort of expanding into business mode surrounding that for about a month.
Yeah, well, so I'm maybe we can come back to the mundane timeline in the story. But on a personal level, one of the things that I wrote about at the beginning of the year that I've definitely seen play out is this tension between trying to make slow, steady, balanced progress, Jupiter and Libra style, versus, you know, needing to change everything up, or, you know, should I, you know, is growth going to come by proceeding in this direction? You know, steadily, or do I need to change things up? Is it like quantum leap, or, you know, do I just need to get out of here? Or do I need to, you know, do this instead? Or do I need to just, you know, stay with it? And this difference between people making leaps to improve things, or, you know, have a revolution personally or otherwise, versus like, actually just instead of, it's sort of like reform or revolution within a person's personal sovereignty, and the like, or in one interfering with the other because they're not sorted out. Anyway, please go ahead, Kelly.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, Austin. The idea of like the change in progress and the extreme fluctuations, is it steady or is it just the breakthrough component? The only other thing I wanted to throw in is how this has affected the generational transit. So for people born in 72, 73, 74, and parts of 75, who are having their Uranus opposition at the same time, this Jupiter-Uranus opposition, you know, so they're having their Uranus opposition transit while transiting Jupiter is conjunct their natal Uranus. So it's sort of playing in to that. So I think in the same way that, you know, the Jupiter square Pluto aspect that we talked a little bit about last month was really triggering a certain pocket of people's Pluto square Pluto transit, this Jupiter Uranus opposition has really amplified or exaggerated the Uranus opposition for a certain portion of the people.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And thinking about some of those people that I know, I can actually connect that with some things I've seen.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it is such, you know, I think Richard Tarnas in his book, Cosmos and Psyche, talks about Jupiter Uranus as this great breakthrough energy of innovation and invention, which I think that it can be, but it does come with those fluctuations and those upheavals, which are more extreme or more dramatic because we have Jupiter representing expansion or just generally being large, amplifying the Uranus cosmic crazy, I guess.
Yeah, he talks, that's a good point. In that chapter in Cosmos and Psyche, Tarnas discusses the Jupiter-Uranus cycle in terms of cultural innovation or change or revolution, or I would say mutation, and that the opposition is the more tense part of that.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of cultures have been going through a period of upheaval. I would also say that if we look at when these things occur historically, those changes are not always for the better. You know, Tarnas does tend to point towards the wonderful breakthroughs rather than the nasty mutations which occur culturally.
At the same time.
That's a really interesting and funny point in terms of like the idea that like Nick Campion talks about the myth of progress, which I don't always agree with, the sort of general statement that things don't necessarily always get better, but sometimes they can take steps backwards or they can devolve, and sort of understanding that or sometimes looking at that in an astrological context can sometimes be hard because oftentimes when you're working with clients or talking to the public, there's a desire to want to use astrology, and some astrologers explicitly go out of their way to use it to try to be like empowering or, you know, insightful or motivating. But sometimes you can have certain aspects where there can be drawbacks or things cannot go well for people or can break down structures in ways that are not desirable.
Yeah. If you look at the last time that Jupiter was opposite Uranus when they were in Libra Aries like this, there were some how should we say, cultural mutations in Germany that I think that no one would regard at this point as positive.
As positive.
You know, I mean, that's one thing, quick side note about the idea of change and the term evolution. You know, I think of, when I think of Uranus, I often think of mutation, right, which is a divergence from the normal. But, you know, in nature, most mutations are dead ends. They're evolutionary dead ends. They're non-viable mutations. And that cultures do that and people do that. You know, fortunately, as we are our own petri dish, we can revert back to the to the previous genome of our life, which we had backed up. But you know, sometimes not every mutation is a viable one.
Sure. Well, I think
that's interesting.
That's a good final point then, maybe, about that Jupiter Uranus opposition. Unless you have anything else, Kelly.
No, I thought, Austin, that sounds really fascinating, but I'm just checking my old school red ephemeris from the 20th century. And yeah, we had Uranus in Aries with the Jupiter and Libra opposition in like 1933, 1934. Good call, Austin. I haven't even thought about that.
Yeah, I did the research on all of that last fall, and I managed to scare myself silly.
Yeah.
And I didn't include it in my write-up.
Of course, you didn't scare anyone else. yeah, that's really interesting. Like, I was like, did we really have Jupiter and Libra the last time Uranus was in Aries? But we did. So very interesting.
So one more thing. I don't know exactly what the story is going to be at, you know, after this is over on a collective level, but But on a personal level, and on the from the perspective of, you know, testing out various life mutations, you know, this is the third and final of the Jupiter Uranus. And so if people have been kind of making changes and experimenting, or forced into, you know, unusual circumstances this year, this is the, you know, this is the last installment in that process. Right. And so part of it will probably come it will bring clarity as to which mutations are viable. Right. Be like, oh, you know what? I don't think I'm going to do that. I've been experimenting with that and that's not what I want to do. And other people might be like, oh no, this worked great. I'm totally building. This is going to be my new baseline. I would say it's the results phase of certain experiments where the hypothesis is either confirmed or denied.
Love it.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something, speaking of, just referring back to, or that connects a little bit to what our experiments that we've been doing and that I've been doing, where I'm thinking back and now I actually remember what March was. March was the point where Austin, you and I, our microphones eventually started breaking down. And so I upgraded and started changing my audio setup. And that eventually acted as a catalyst to, over the course of the last few months, using Zoom again and starting to do the live streams and starting to do video and everything else. And that's something that we're still working out and still getting used to as we have been over the past few months. And this is only, I think, our third attempt at doing it again since we resumed doing that after like a 1 or 2 year hiatus while I was writing the book. So yeah, we'll have to see. Our next episode will actually be right around the time of that Jupiter-Uranus opposition. And we'll have to figure out, you know, whether they keep doing that or what sort of format works in terms of this and where to continue to take things in the future. So I forgot at the top of the episode to mention the stuff that we meant to promote. So maybe we should do a minute to do that really quickly before we wrap things up. Kelly, do you have any events or things coming up in the near future?
I do. Two quick ones to mention. I am teaching a pre-conference workshop as part of the Calgary Astrology Conference, which is happening in September in Calgary. And the pre-conference workshop is on Fidaria and perfection. So we're just going to look at some older timing techniques. And then the second event, I will be in Sydney in early October, and I'm doing an intro to really Hellenistic ideas. So whole sign houses, the idea of sect, and the idea is to keep that workshop a little on the intimate side so we can introduce some of these concepts that are Hellenistic in nature and see how that might change attendees' charts. So if you're confused about whole sign houses or sect, then if you're in Sydney, come along, and the details are on my website. So those are my next two big things.
Awesome. That sounds good. And your website is kellysastrology.com?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. And Austin, what do you have going on?
Oh, I'm going to be writing. So, you know, I do a Patreon-funded column. I do a column every decan and then dailies all month and then a monthly piece. This upcoming September, I'll begin teaching an introduction to synodic cycles class, and that starts on the 23rd. And I will be teaching my first class on zodiacal releasing. And so that's a month-long class, and that's going to begin on the 9th. So that'll be interesting.
Okay.
Been doing it for a long time, but I've never really taught it before. So put my ideas into a teachable form.
Awesome. That should be good. And your website is austincopic.com?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And people should check that out there. I mentioned how Dimitri and I were going to do a show. We were going to do a show and have a great discussion about the development of the significations of the houses, which hopefully at some point in the future we'll still be able to do. I did promise her I would mention the thing that she was actually coming on the show to promote, which is that in October she's doing a 5-day retreat / intensive on Hellenistic Time Lord techniques, where she's actually going to go through several different Hellenistic Time Lord techniques over the course of a week and do a full presentation on those. So that's going to be in Portland, I believe, in October. Mm-hmm. And you can find out more information about that on her website at demetrageorge.com. And just click on the page that says schedule, and you'll see that event scheduled, and you can find out more information about it. And as for me, I'm just going to keep doing the podcast. In my Hellenistic course, we've started doing some live readings of texts where we're reading through Vedius Valens together and going through some of his example charts and actually talking about and sort of dissecting his approach to delineating birth charts from the second century. So you can find out more information about that on my website or my course site, which is theastrologyschool.com. And I think that's it. So that's it for the September forecast. So thanks, guys, for joining me. And thanks to our audience. We had about 22 patrons who joined us today, who are supporters of the show. So thanks for joining us and making some comments during the course of the show. And we will reconvene again in a month to talk about the forecast for October. All right. Well, thanks for joining me today, guys.
Thanks for having us, Chris. That was fun.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
All right. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.